Hello and welcome to the Wonder Baba podcast. My name is Sheena Mitchell. I'm a pharmacist and mum of three. I'm here to chat all about child and family health. I really hope you enjoy the show. This podcast is proudly sponsored by Medicare FemSense, Ireland's newest and most innovative ovulation tracking solution. The Medicare FemSense Smart Temperature Patch is comfortable and discreet and is worn under your arm during your fertile window to measure and confirm ovulation. Women have reported a 93% success rate in detecting ovulation, with over 10,000 pregnancies already recorded. Visit flemingmedical.ie/FemSense for more details. Today I'm joined by Lucy Wolfe, the sleep expert. From looking into your website a bit more, I learned that you're much more than a sleep expert. You are a co-creational psychotherapist. So just before we start off, I'm wondering, could you explain that to me a little bit?
I can, of course. This is a new departure for me because about 6 years ago, I went back to education and did a higher diploma, like a level 8 in parent mentoring and relationship studies. And then I've just now finished my master's in the psychotherapy of co-creational relationship studies. And I began that education journey because my children were becoming teenagers, and I felt that I wasn't really that equipped to deal with the teenage years. The course was being run here in UCC, and I thought that I would go and do it in two ways. Do it to try and help my own understanding about teenagers, essentially, because I was one of the modules. And also to add a layer to my therapeutic practice that already existed. And then ultimately it became so much more than that for me, kind of ended up going on like a personal development journey as well as a professional journey. And I guess I do only a very small amount of, let's say, what I would say pure psychotherapy, because mostly I'm layering that into the work that I do with parents who come to me for sleep work. So they don't really know that that's what they're getting, but it's kind of just like filtered in through it.
And actually, I think that's so important in a way for people to know, because it just marries in so well to your existing qualifications to help understand where parents are coming from, whatever traumas they could have had, whether it be just as a child themselves growing up, what they're bringing forward with them maybe, or a difficult labour, anything like that, and just the exhaustion of being a new mum. All of those things can leave people quite traumatised or affected in a way that might then affect their parenting and their behaviour and attitude towards sleep. So they kind of integrate really, really well. And I'd imagine allow you to have huge empathy then and understanding for the parents. So it's a much more holistic approach than just dealing with the baby.
Yeah, that's it, exactly. And I suppose because my work is only ever with the parent, it's brought an amazing depth to my practice, I will say that. And I suppose I feel it has made me a more effective practitioner. And also on the other side of that, it made me a much more effective parent myself, and things that, let's say, I feel I probably was struggling with as a parent as my children were getting older. It helped me hugely to kind of excavate and work on my own understanding of my own childhood and experiences, and then my own behaviours and how they were affecting my children and vice versa. And so, yeah, look, it's been amazing. And I guess for me, I love learning and I have a huge curiosity. I have a very deep interest in the perinatal period, essentially, and essentially mothers and how they are experiencing their parenting journey. And then I suppose because it's about me, like seeing my own self 20 years ago becoming a parent and how I struggled with the elements that I probably help people with now, because really that's what brought me to this place, Sheena, that I struggled with my first child's sleep and there were really no resources. And as a result of that, I started to do training and education so that I could become the person that I felt I needed at that time. And I guess that's just continued to grow and evolve. And I hope that it will continue to do that as well.
That is fascinating, really, because just look at you for a minute, right? So you can't get your baby to sleep. So you're like, I know, I'll actually go and become a fully fledged expert. And then you're like, oh, here we are, the teenage years, they're tricky. I know, I'll become a co-creational psychotherapist so I can do that. I'm like, most people would just sit back and go, oh God, someone help me.
I've always been on a quest asked. And yeah, I guess rather than just go and take the course, I want to go and do the course and be it. And think that I have a massive belief in personal and professional development, like I really do. And I kind of feel that I have always felt this, and I believe it to be true, that I've just got so much to offer. And, you know, I got to a stage in an original career that I had that I just felt, oh my goodness, I don't want to just do this forever. I think there's so much more to give, which then led me on that little journey and leaves me in this really privileged position to be holding space with parents, helping them, making a difference. Because look, you know how challenging it can really be when a person in the family doesn't sleep well. And, you know, Sheena, we're not talking about your typical infant sleep expectation. You know, the parents that come to me, they're often struggling with a child who's 6 months plus, first of all, and that could be up to 6 years of age. That baby might be waking every 40 minutes. They may be waking for up to 3 hours in the overnight period. They might be waking at 4 or 5 a.m. to start the day. Some of them stay awake for 3 hours overnight. Some of them are waking after 20 minutes on each nap. And as a result, there's this huge knock-on effect to the family unit. So for me, oh my goodness, what a privilege, really.
Yeah, and it is, it really is. Sleep is everything. And without sleep, it can just potentiate so many more issues and even kind of feed into postnatal depression and, I suppose, arguments in the house. And it really, no sleep can just be the perfect storm. And as you said there, it's probably very important that you're not talking about the people who, like me, had unrealistic sleep expectations of their children and who had to come to terms pretty quickly that they were being ridiculous. But it's for those really difficult cases. Have you found that by keeping on top of a term that in pharmacy we know very well, CPD, so continued professional development, have you found that that has evolved your techniques? I know that you have adopted a stay and support method. So is that something that evolved over time?
I guess that's nearly always been very close to how I began as a practitioner, because I did a lot of training overseas in both the States and the UK. And between those trainings, I kind of developed like a hybrid. So as a parent, I was really uncomfortable with the concepts of crying out or controlled crying as a norm. I really felt there must be something else. And so when I went and did various courses, some of them were advocating for that and some of them were advocating for more, let's say, gentle approaches. And for me, it would always need to be a gentle approach. And so the stay and support approach allowed for parents and really encourages parents to be really physically, emotionally and available to their child as they accompany them on that journey. And I've adopted that from really early on in my practice. I think what really changed how I practiced, though, is when you put hundreds of parents through your hands, that you start to see themes and patterns that you have never really been taught, but it's practice informed. So like identifying what balances work much better from a timing perspective, what wake windows work. You know, again, these concepts are out there, but I guess I believe that I finally tuned them and feel that I can read someone's notes and actually know things that they haven't told me from just reading the notes, if that makes any sense to you. But that comes from years of experience. It comes from years of just being on the ground and, like I say, putting people through your hands and being in the honored position that people trust you to do that. I guess even just how I now am able to hold myself when I'm holding them, that's probably really evolved and become, you know, much stronger and more capable, for sure.
Confidence feeds confidence. So if you're able to show that you will be able to fix any problem, that the problem is transient and you just need to find the right approach and work through it as a family, knowing that can even be probably such a big relief for parents to know that they have support and they're not alone and that they're able to.
And you see, when they come to me first, like the first email, you know, that's a huge decision for someone to make, to send that email to say, I need a consultation with you. Like, no one takes that email lightly. But then when we meet, and I suppose everything is by Zoom, even though obviously 60% of my work was always online, even pre-pandemic, I guess one of the first things I always tell parents, this is going to be fine. We are going to get there. that is what people need to hear. It's going to be okay. And although I'm very realistic as a practitioner, and if I have concerns, but especially when there are maybe, you know, pink to red flags of underlying medical issues that are typically in the sort of digestive discomfort world, I'm always very realistic with parents from the get-go to say, look, I'm a bit concerned about this. I'm going to do what I do. And then if I feel there's something else here, I'm going to refer you back out. And again, that does take a really seasoned practitioner to have that confidence. They need to hear that. Like even just recently, we've got a couple of dogs here and we got a woman in to help us control the dogs. So I didn't go off and become a dog trainer. I said I would get somebody in.
That's next.
But then, you know, during the meeting, she never told me it was going to be okay. Does that make sense?
Yes.
And I just remembered coming away saying, remember to always tell your parents it's going to be okay.
Yeah.
Like, don't forget, because she forgot to tell us it was going to be okay. Like, I mean, they weren't even doing anything that crazy, but like, I was a bit like, oh my God, I'm so demented. They don't stop barking when this happens or whatever. And I suppose that's what we need. We need reassurance, don't we?
Yeah.
We need reassurance and we need support. We need to feel support. We need to feel heard. And again, if I can be that person for our parent, whether that's in a one-to-one consultation or on my social media platforms, even for a nanosecond, I feel that's what parents possibly need. Yeah.
As you said there, it's a very weighted decision to send that email request off. And probably a lot of that stems from people maybe having fears that using a sleep expert may involve certain techniques that it doesn't, or that it may be an issue for, say, breastfeeding or if they want to co-sleep. And like you already explained there, general crying it out techniques that maybe are recommended by some. So I think it's really good for people to know that that's not the case. You can be supported along with your choices.
I feel so passionately about that because I suppose sleep can be so controversial. You don't need me to tell you that. And it can be, and it's so emotionally driven. And there are schools of thought, various schools of thought. For me, I support any parent in decisions that they're making because that's their decisions. But I like those decisions to be informed decisions. And I suppose a lot of the time parents might come and they want to just give up breastfeeding because it has become, they feel like part of the problem. And honestly, when we work on helping their child sleep better, it is not about giving up things, ditching dummies, not room sharing, giving up breastfeeding. It's about finding that co-creational, collaborative way forward with huge emphasis and priority emphasis on the child and the parent emotional well-being. And that's at its very center. And, you know, I had a client recently that I was working with, and again, a very specific case, and it's not exactly where I'd like it to be just yet. And, you know, we talk very openly about it together, my client and myself, about, you know, what I think this looks like. And they just said, you know what? Okay, we're not exactly there, but we're so much closer to our child from the work that we've done. And then I'm kind of like, oh my goodness, the work here is done. You know, that if we can help parents make informed decisions, it's not about giving up things and it's not about throwing your child's emotional well-being under the bus. In fact, it's the very opposite of that. And I think that it's about giving parents choices and more than anything, helping them understand, you know, the way that sleep itself works and what helps sleep and what maybe promotes sleep and what maybe is diluting their effort. And then your baby's body is designed to sleep. If we show them how in a really gentle, considered way, they're going to reach their personal best as you navigate that with them. And I believe in the body. I believe in the bond between the child and the parent. And I know that we can make those improvements in that really comprehensive way.
It just reminds me of when I had my first baby, who is now 10, and I'm a really organized person to my detriment. So I thought I could absolutely manage this baby without any consideration to really their needs. I thought I had it cracked from reading books and being so prepared pre-birth and pre-even meeting the child. And I do feel that for several months after her birth, I fought against her and struggled against her, and all in, I suppose, trying to achieve pointless goals, even to do with sleep and feeding and everything. And when I had my second child pretty soon after that, I won't lie, I was just a different mother. And I always look back and go, I really wish I had just chilled out or allowed myself to actually respond to the individual child that was in front of me. And one of the funny things that I missed, really, I feel, on her was sleep cues. So I decided that, you know, maybe she was going to sleep at this time, this time, this time. And I would keep her awake and miss sleep cues or maybe affect her naps negatively during the day. All of the kind of behavior that I now know from having, you know, a second and third child is really detrimental to their overall sleep patterns and can cause overtiredness as a problem, which is, you know, was just a disaster. So do you find that a lot of people don't know how to actually see things like sleep cues and are hard on themselves in the start?
Yeah, and I think that, you know, you've got so many different cohorts. You know, let's say you had this sort of, I'm going to fit her into this and whatever that was based on. You were where you needed to be, and that helped inform your parenting career.
It was just very uninformed.
But you see, I suppose then you allowed yourself to grow and develop, and then you become a slightly different parent, different views, philosophies. Like I always say, look, you actually don't really know what kind of parent you're going to be before you have your baby. But actually, by the time you get to 3 or 4, you're such a different person than the person that was in the maternity hospital number one. And like, I mean, we called our first child the apprentice because ultimately that's what he's been. And he's clearing the pathway very well for all the others. And like sometimes I just say to him, oh, I'm so sorry, Jesse, because, you know, he might say, there's no way I'd have been allowed to speak to you like that. Or there's no way I'd be able to watch that television program. Oh, there's absolutely no way I'd stay up that late. And I'm just like, I'm so sorry. But I was only learning on the job as well. First of all, I don't know, do parents adequately prepare for the world of sleep before their birth? So I think that unfortunately, there is a vulnerability that the process before your baby is born is spent focusing on, and rightly so in some ways, the birth and your feeding practice and your antenatal care. And there is no real emphasis on sleep unless you actively look for it yourselves. And most parents don't really anticipate they're going to have a sleep problem unless they've maybe been exposed to friends or, you know, family members who've really been in the depth of it. I don't think their antenna is up from a sleep perspective until after the birth. And then it's nearly, I'm not saying it's too late, but you know, once baby is born, your focus is completely diluted because you're stretching so many different ways as you try and navigate these first few weeks and months. And I do think that understanding the language of sleep, I would consider that to be the most important piece of the initial puzzle that you could understand, if that makes any sense to you. And I suppose looking for those early cues like brief eye rubs, brief yawns at moments of quiet, instead of waiting for or ignoring late cues like intense eye rubbing, big tight yawning, agitation. And whenever I'm with people, like a crowd of parents, and I ask the question, you know, what does your child do when they get tired? They will nearly always give me the overtired symptoms rather than the getting tired symptoms. And I think that, again, it's just something that's missing in our understanding and maybe in our information that we seek. And that can make such a difference, because once that cortisol goes into the system, the body starts to fight sleep, and that has that kind of impact on the rest of the how your child has experienced their sleep. Like somebody described yesterday to me that their child was hysterically overtired, and I thought it was like a brilliant description, because actually it's perfect. So I suppose just trying to avoid overtiredness, but more than anything, like I put emphasis on those first few months. First of all, having low expectations. Although somebody recently said to me the other day, how long do you have the low expectations for? So just to clarify, I have low expectations, but I always aim high because I want to promote my child's sleep best, my child's personal sleep best. So I'm expecting very little, but I'm always aiming high. And then I'm really focusing on getting to know them and building that loving trust bond, which comes quite naturally a lot of the time, that you start to become attuned to your baby. You're starting to have dialogues with them. You're making eye contact, you're chatting with them, and you're starting to maybe acknowledge their feeding cue. And in tandem with that, I start to see, can I read their sleep cue? And you can support that further by underpinning the circadian rhythm, because that has such a huge influence on your child's sleeping pattern. And like the circadian rhythm manifests in the womb, right? It's not mature until they're gone 4, but it's there and it has such a huge emphasis on sleep. But quite early on, I'm an advocate of regular wake times, exposure to bright and natural light whenever possible, when it's awake time. I like to create what I call a feeding and sleeping balance, very flexible, but I like to kind of feel that maybe your feeds and your sleeps run in sync with each other and they don't clash with each other too much. And I just even understand that maybe your baby is going to need to feed probably every 1 to 3 hours, depending on your feeding practice. But they're going to need to sleep every 1 to 2 hours, and understanding that, because, you know, let's say you're a little girl and my little boy, they could power through. And so we thought that was great, powering through.
Yeah.
But they're not supposed to do that, because then when they do that, then they get really overtired and it plays out in lots of different ways. So we can all pull the all-nighter, but it's not good for us. And so just acknowledging that and understanding it and maybe preparing them and helping them. But the other side of that as well is that, you know, our new babies come and they often need lots of support. They need lots of cuddles, they need lots of holding, they need lots of motion, they like rhythm and sucking. And I guess I really encourage parents to lean into that season as well.
And that's lovely. And that they're the parts that I think are good for the mum's soul as well, and allow that nurturing relationship to develop. I think, yeah, it's a wonderful part of parenting. I still now will hug anyone who's running around here who'll give me a chance to.
Well, that's it, you see, and I suppose that real responsive parenting begins the moment. Well, it begins from conception, but like as soon as you have your babe in arms, like that's when you're really going to move into your, and it won't always feel amazing. Of course it won't. And you won't feel like you're enjoying every part of it. Of course you won't. It's really, really hard. However, it'll still be the best experience that you'll ever have within a theme, if that makes any sense to you as well.
Yes. And in terms of creating a sleep environment, you know, there's just so much out there. If you are a new parent and you're like, do I need to have music? Do I need to read to them? Do I need to have white noise? What temperature should the room be? Should there be lights? Shouldn't there be lights? You're going, this is something that I have not studied enough. Like, what is the best way to create an atmosphere? And how does that differ between naps and nighttime sleep?
So I suppose I always begin to concentrate first of all around the bedtime piece, and your bedtime with your young baby, so your weeks old baby, is actually quite late. It's your bedtime.
Yeah.
And I suppose they're going to sleep in your bedroom. So the health agenda supports that we room share for at least the first 6 months. And most parents will have invested in something similar to like a co-sleeper. It was a Moses basket in my day, bassinet type thing, but something for next to the bed for your baby to sleep in. And then I suppose, like, I don't feel you need a whole lot. Like, you need to be dark enough. It needs to be, you know, somewhere between 16 and 20 degrees, dressed appropriately for the season. And I guess from a nighttime feeding perspective, I would say, look, have a nightlight, have things at your disposal, and try to keep things low key. But I'm not an advocate of not looking in your baby's eyes when you're doing a night feed. Like, I'm really a big advocate of responsive parenting 24 hours a day, so that, you know, you're engaging with your baby. No, you're not going to be roughhousing or anything like that. Like, you want them to go back to sleep after their feed. But, you know, I think it's a good idea to keep it in the bedroom rather than going downstairs or leaving the bedroom to do the feed. And it just needs to be dark, cool, comfortable, and safe.
You're going to be eating a granola bar or something. Like, I just have visions of my nightstand. It was all about food for me.
Oh, really? Right. I just remember like having all my little basket of all my little bits and pieces. And like when you start to get confident, like you'll only change the nappy when you really feel like you need to and things like that. And like that all takes time to gain confidence. And then I suppose your baby is born, but they're not making melatonin yet. So during the day, that's why we try to expose them to bright light during the day. And then we use dimmer, darker light in the evening time. By about 8 weeks plus though, your baby's making their own melatonin. And so I suppose then I might start making it dark for daytime sleep as well. And at some point between 8 weeks and 12 weeks, you potentially would put baby up to their own bedroom for a nap or two throughout the course of the day, whatever feels comfortable for you. But I suppose you're looking to use the dark to initiate sleep in the overnight period. And then just understanding that that late bedtime that is there in the early weeks and months gets earlier and earlier. So that typically sometime around the 16-week mark, that 4-month mark, young children's bedtimes probably range then somewhere between 6 and 8 p.m. And I suppose most of the time, a very appropriate bedtime is probably sometime around 7 to 8 for most young children. And I suppose for me as a practitioner, and again, this is very much informed by practice, I find when I'm dealing with children who are struggling with their sleep, I aim for the early bedtime, the 7 o'clock bedtime, because I'm normally dealing with an overtired child and I'm trying to dilute their overtired tank, as I call it, and I'm trying to stop it filling and spilling. So again, I often start there. And then as I'm doing that, I'm trying to see, what are they showing me? What's the communication? You know, am I putting them to bed at 7 and they're never asleep until 8? So it's 8 o'clock their actual bedtime. So I always encourage parents like to follow my guidance within a framework, but always start at the lower end of the scale and then start to see what your baby is responding like and what they feel like they need from you.
If your baby, say, is struggling with naps during the day, how does that feed into, I suppose, the evening sleep and bedtime? And it's a bit of a dark hole of...
Daytime sleep gets organized way before the daytime sleep gets organized. And I suppose for me as a practitioner, I tend to take children's sleep in two halves. So under 6 months as a cohort, and then 6 months to 6 years as another. Now that's totally okay. Disproportionate, but there's obviously very good reasons behind that, because of sleep maturation and development, emotional development, physical development of your young child. So I suppose in these early few months, I focus much more on having very flexible feeding and sleep and balances, knowing that bedtime's quite late and then it gets earlier and earlier. And again, depending on how able your baby seems in terms of sleep, I engage in a lot of comfort in terms of contact nap. I sling them, I swing them, I stroller them, I do what I need to do to get them through the day, to nap them if they find it challenging. I'll always look for parents to try and initiate their child's sleep ability by maybe using my percentage of wakefulness approach, which we use at bedtime stacked with a bedtime routine. It's here that we try and help your baby be a little bit awake, a little bit aware of going into their cot or their co-sleeper at bedtime itself. And then this way, what we're doing is we're initiating what I call sleep ability, but it's sometimes referred to as self-settling, if that makes sense to you. And again, we just move the needle of that as time goes by. Now, as your child gets older, bedtime gets earlier, sleep gets more organized, and nap rhythms start to establish themselves. We sort of feel sometimes from around 6 months plus, which means that children who have only been doing 20 to 30 minutes at a time now have the potential to sleep for longer, but it's complicated. So day sleep affects nighttime sleep, nighttime sleep affects daytime sleep, and it goes around in this collective cycle. So I tend to split up sleep into segments, like bedtime segment, overnight segment, early morning segment. What I always look for is, or ask the question is, how does your child experience sleep? And the question really is asking, is your child able to put themselves to sleep themselves at bedtime? Mostly, the child is not able to do that, or they're only doing it in a partial capacity. And as a result of that, we start to see your baby waking on their natural sleep phases. So we're on audio and I'm doing all sorts of gesturing because I always do like a phase of sleep where my hand goes up and down to show you sleep.
Beautiful
cycles.
Waves there, beautiful waves.
Gorgeous, right? But basically what happens as the biology of your sleep, your child's sleep starts to lock into place, their brain keeps coming up to the surface to check and see, is everything the same as it was when I first went to sleep? So if things that you've been doing have changed, which could be anything from a bottle, a nipple, a dummy, a hand, a arm around them, the location changed. If things have changed, then often we see more wakening and your baby's signaling and asking you to get them back to sleep. So what we try to do when we're working on sleep is, not only do we honor, you know, feeding and sleeping balance, and we try to dilute overtiredness, we also try to initiate sleep ability, which really is helping your child learn to get to sleep themselves. And that is where the stay and support approach comes into play, Sheena, because that's the bridge between what you've been doing and how you help your child learn to get to sleep themselves, which on its own doesn't stop night waking. But what it does is it allows night waking to be worked on. And in turn, it allows daytime sleep to also be addressed. Yeah. And it's a sequence of events. If we implement it in that cycle, so I always work on bedtime, I then begin to work on the overnight and the early morning, and then I can start to work on daytime sleep and lengthening daytime sleep as well. But if we do it in the reverse order, we probably find it really difficult.
Yeah, it's fascinating, because as a parent myself, I pretty much celebrated as much as I ever have anything in my life when my child has just managed to fall asleep by themselves in the cot, or such a good feeling. And you can just see then how that enables them to go back to sleep. If they wake, they, you know, as you said there, that makes complete sense to me. They're not looking for what's missing. And that can be the really challenging part. Yeah.
And that's why I use that word sleepability, because I felt like I love descriptions, if that makes any sense to you. So I'm always talking about overtired tanks and draining them and things like that. But I love the word sleepability because it kind of denotes for me the ableness. I can put myself to sleep, which allows me to begin to put myself back to sleep. But even that on its own isn't enough. It's always about treating all of the areas. And daytime sleep, nap deprivation will affect nighttime sleep. But actually, it's not an area I worry too much about. So often parents are really concerned about nap deprivation. And I think it's just another challenge for parents. Like, they hear about these kind of 2 hour naps and they hear about the shoulds and things like that. And I try and normalize things a little bit. Like, obviously, if I get a 2 hour nap, I'm going to do the little victory dance with you too. But if I get an hour, I'm really doing great. Do you know that kind of way? And I suppose, again, it's about understanding that, like, mostly when I'm working with a family, I'm hoping for at least 40 minutes on one nap and at least an hour plus on another. And after that, it's a bonus. And I mean that sincerely. And again, I really try and normalize, you know, expectations, because somewhere there's this discourse of 2 hour naps and 7 to 7s. And look, the reality of it is quite different to that. And as soon as we can understand that more and embrace that, I think the parenting journey gets that a little bit easier, because then we're not spending our whole time thinking like we're doing something wrong. What I do think is important, though, is nap balances. And there's two that I find to be very significant. One is when the nap balance is top heavy. So what I mean by that is when your child is 6 months plus and they're doing 2 or 3 naps a day, when the first nap of the day is longer and stronger than the rest of the daytime sleep, that's a nap imbalance to me. That means they're always going to be overtired at bedtime, even if they've had enough daytime sleep. So I'm looking at distribution of sleep.
That makes a lot of sense.
Okay. Right. And I'm always looking for the second nap to be the stronger of the two or equal to the first, so that distribution is good. And the other balance I look at is the wake period between the last nap and bedtime. Now, I obviously think I'm like a broken record because I'm always talking about this, but this might be the first time someone's heard this too, Sheena.
Basically,
I explore the relationship between the end of day sleep and bedtime. And I find that there are certain hours that match age ranges. So between the age of 4 months and 8 months, most kids do really well if they only are awake for around 2 to 3 hours between the last nap and bedtime. Okay. So by the time we get into this sort of age range, I probably do avoid naps much after 5 so that I can be a bed asleep probably close to 7. And that seems to synchronize with the hormonal system, the biological rhythm, and that helps our young children go into deeper, more restful sleep as a result. Okay. Yeah. From 8 months to 18 months, that gap between, I call it the nap gap dynamic, it tends to be 3 to 4 hours. And then from 18 months to 3 years of age, well, then we no longer nap or close to not napping. That gap is 4 to 5 hours. You'll hear there's kind of bandwidths there. When I'm working with overtired children, which is all of the time, I always work on the lower end of the scale until they show me what they can do.
Yeah, there's a lot to it. And I'm going, Lucy, where were you 10 years ago? Just saying, I needed you in my life.
I was actually here.
I'm going, you didn't call. You left me tired for so long. I find, you know, figuring that all out is really hard. So it's
so hard. And I suppose I sometimes feel like, oh, do you just complicate it? Because I'm using all this different language, because I love descriptions and I love people to understand. Like, I obviously could just come and tell you what to do, but I love people to really understand why we're doing it, because then I feel we're future-proofing your sleep and your parenting going forward, that, you know, you have an understanding of how these things kind of operate. And then once they're integrated, like, you don't have to do mathematic Olympics every night. Once it's integrated, your baby is going to keep showing you what they need. And then you're really in communication, you're really attuned. Because, you know, like you were talking about when you missed sleep cues or, you know, disregarded sleep cues, loads of kids don't give sleep cues, and they don't give sleep cues for loads of different reasons. So one of the primary reasons can be that they've had a reflux journey or something in that theme, like a digestive discomfort under that blanket term. Yeah. As a result of that, I find they get really poor at communication. They don't really know what to tell you, when to tell you, because they've been suffering. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah.
So those babies find it difficult to communicate. So parents who have been asked to read sleep cues are probably going, what? Okay. So and then there's other like temperaments, like where young children, they give you false cues, or they're so overtired they're rubbing eyes after 20 minutes of waking up, but also ones that just don't want to miss out. You know, these are typically siblings.
FOMO.
Yeah, well, you see, there you go, right? So I suppose sometimes when I'm working with a family, and then a lot of the time, actually, I work off bandwidths of time just to hijack the body clock. So like I sometimes say, look, it's a 2 hour bandwidth, give or take, for your child's age range. Let's just start the nap an hour and 40 minutes after getting up. And then we're always going to be there when the biological sleep wave kind of comes down. You don't have to go insane looking for cues either.
No, and I think that's really useful as well, talking about flexibility within the plans, because you know, my two daughters, there was 15 months between them, and you're trying to figure out sleep patterns that suit both children. One of them is kind of dropping that afternoon nap. One of them, you know, so you're trying to coordinate a little bit, let's be honest.
Totally. And like, I mean, that stage, you didn't even know your own name, right?
Exactly.
And like, that is the reality. So like, I suppose it's easy for me to start firing out numbers like this, but like, of course I understand that it's always in a wider context. But, you know, when we're really on our knees, I just focus on one child temporarily, because, you know, although sleep can take time to improve, once you begin to work on it, it does improve. Like, it has an ability to kind of come up to the surface, and then you can turn your attention back to the wider construct of what's happening within your family. And, you know, juggling two children at bedtime, three children, four children at bedtime. And like, it's all manageable. It's all challenging, but every part of it is anyway. Right.
Yeah. Oh, many a night I've sat with a child in a sling while putting another one, reading another one.
Oh, totally. Like, I have visions of myself actually. Like, I had three under four, which is probably, and you had probably better than that, right? But I remember like having one in my arms, one kind of like using my foot to make them go up the stairs. Yeah. And then I can't remember when I was doing the other one, but he was probably hanging off the light shade. And I tried to get them up. And then I could hear my husband's car in the driveway, and I would like at the window saying, "Don't come in."
Oh. Or the dogs bark and you're like, what are they trying to do to me?
No, I mean, it is like, I've been there, I've been at the cold face, and not only, let's say, all the journey, training, information, and practice informed, I always come back to what I would be doing as well, what seemed to work, what was helpful. And like that, I would never ask a parent to do something that I wouldn't have been willing to do myself.
And this is something that I really wanted to ask about. Obviously, breastfeeding or bottle feeding a child to sleep can have a very hypnotic effect, the old milk coma, as it's known.
Yeah.
Is that process, is that something that should be, I suppose, encouraged or avoided?
You see, I'd encourage it, but then I end up having this kind of dichotomous approach then around it, because feeding to sleep, feeding close to sleep time, like you say, has this hypnotic effect. Breast milk has all the gorgeous cocktail of hormones that, and that's the natural way to help a child, to lull them to sleep. And it fills their tummy, and this is really organic and very close to what we would want for your family. The problem seems to be that sleep's got its own design.
Yeah.
Okay, so sleep and feeding often clash, because sleep's got its own design, in so much as, like, the sleep researchers talk about sleep onset disorders when they talk about feeding to sleep, because they say that, you know, if you feed to sleep, then that's what's contradicting the sleep pattern. And that's why we look at separating feeding from sleep. Okay, what I encourage is feed your baby to sleep. And in the first few months, work on having them a little bit less than completely asleep on the boob or the bottle before you put them into their cot, their co-sleeper. And that way they're doing some of the sleep work for themselves. So I call it a percentage of wakefulness approach, which means that they're 100% asleep initially. And over time, you might start having them 95%, 5% awake, aware, a little bit aware, 90 to 10%. So that maybe we get 70-30 ratio. That's enough for your baby to start to cycle through some of those sleep phases in these early few months.
There's just two things that kind of link there as well, in that sleep ability. As you say, if the boob isn't there when they wake up and they are used to it, it can be hard for them to settle themselves back down without boob, even though they don't actually want to feed, they just want the comfort. And obviously the comfort, like, I know I was coming, I went back to work after maternity leaves because, you know, I work for myself, and I'd come in and that late feed, like, I used to go up and give them a sneaky little breastfeed at night, and it was the most magical part of my day. Yeah. And, you know, you kind of, I think a lot of mums nearly need that for them more than necessarily for the baby. And, you know, I think it was well worth it. But
and you see, I think that there's not to be any shoulds or have tos. Does that make any sense to you? But I suppose if we understand that there is this relationship between what happens to me at bedtime often needs to be replicated through the night, and not all of the time, because there are loads and loads of children who are fed to sleep in any capacity who maintain their nighttime sleep profile. Why is that? Generally, I would say that they've got regularity somewhere. They've got a regular timing. They're content. They're able to stitch their sleep cycles together. But there is a huge percentage of babies that just are not able to do that. And their sleep ability needs to be on the higher end of the scale. And that's where that, when they get that little bit older, if we're struggling, I tend to separate the last feed from sleep. Now, literature says 30 minutes between the two is enough to weaken that. However, I find in my practice, I need at least 45 minutes between finishing the feed and sleep to kind of, I call it muscle memory. I know that it isn't, but I feel that the muscle memory of the sucking to sleep remains unless we've got a 45 minute clearance between the two items.
The other thing, just from a pharmacist perspective, is yes, that often feeding to sleep does not a lot of good for a windy baby, because you don't have a good opportunity to wind them afterwards. And if you have a refluxy or colicky baby, that's not going to sit well, and they're going to wake much more quicker maybe than they would have if you'd had time to give them a little winding, you know?
Yeah. And you see, I suppose, I think it's whatever feels right for you. But like, if some of this, if you're struggling with your sleep and some of this starts to make a little bit of sense, then there's nothing to stop you starting to make small changes. It's only about repositioning feeds. It's not about not feeding. They're still getting all those gorgeous hormone cocktail into their body, but it's just a slightly earlier time. So they're starting to kind of put themselves to sleep. And like I said, there's no have to's, but it's just about understanding that. And then, like, you know, you describe about those magical nighttime parenting moments, like only parents that you and I can look back with nostalgia and melancholy of the, you know, the quietness of the night where it's only you and baby. And like, certainly when you have more than one child, that is nearly the only time you get to spend on your own with the new person. And it is magical. There's a quietness that sort of descends upon you. And it's something I don't know, do we cherish enough? Do we encourage parents, look, just enjoy that? Like, I know it's not enough to say, look, if this too shall pass, okay, especially when you're in the trenches. But I guess if we can embrace our parenting in that capacity and keep looking at things in that positive light, and then behind the scenes be working on, you know, how you feed, how you sleep, and how you're parenting, then you're bringing everything up to the surface and you're moving into that really conscious, loving parenting framework that I would really heavily endorse.
Yeah. And shining a light on the fact that it's not all rosy, because I'm thinking, while I have such rose-tinted memories of those feeds that I used to come in and do a little dream feed because I'd have been working late or whatever, there's also been nights where I'd come in and my husband would pretty much have to march me up the stairs because I'd be,
totally.
I'm dead.
I remember, like, I used to lie on the bed and I used to say, look, if I count to 20, would he get up instead of me? You know, you'd be like just stuck to the bed, like so tired. And then I'd go, I'll count to 20. And then he wouldn't. And then I might say, I'll go to 40. And then I'd just see... It's just hard. Like, I remember the mornings where you'd be so tired and then like you might be only got one child back to sleep and then the older child is awake looking to start the day. And just this evening, I just went for a walk on my own, but I took a route that I used to take with my double buggy and I haven't taken it for ages. And I was just thinking, oh, I just remember walking up here and being just like so tired, as well as pushing 5 stone up the road between the two of them and the buggy itself. And you know me, I'm always trying to keep it real, because I suppose I don't want it always to sound like it's so difficult and challenging, but I want to acknowledge that it is, because otherwise people think that it should be Instagram nurseries, perfect bodies, relationships, etc. But I never want to lose sight of the fact of the flip side of how gorgeous, how loving, how joyous that it also is. So it's that high, low dichotomy, essentially.
And I think that's the lovely thing, just encouraging parents at the time to think, okay, life is chaotic around me, but this moment, this is a good one.
Yeah, it is, like, you know, and like I suppose I mean my kids are aged now between 19 and 11. There used to be toys everywhere, and there isn't now. It's different. And like, even just this evening, my older two children, they've got things on, they don't even want to have a conversation with me tonight. And I just kind of was like, oh, okay. Yeah. And then you're like,
be my friend.
No, that's not every day. Like, they want me sometimes, but like just tonight, they were like, on a mission. And I wasn't part of that. And there's a sadness attached to that too. So if we can just stay present, in as difficult as it is, whenever it is, and just trying to hold it together in so much as bringing it back to having that really deep, loving relationship with yourself as a parent. I think I learned that in the course of my journey, to be kinder to myself, to be less critical, less hard on myself, you know, to leave behind any comparison at all. And I think in this modern world, it's really difficult to avoid comparison because we're sort of exposed to everybody else's journey or their highlights anyway of it.
Yeah, which, as you've rightly acknowledged, it isn't the reality. You know, you're sharing the photo, not the video.
Absolutely, yeah, that's it.
For those parents who are finding themselves doing weird acrobatics, trying to get themselves like some sort of ninja out of the room while the baby is drifting off, is there a good approach in trying to remove your physical self from maybe an older child, kind of the 6 months to 6 years? Like, there'll be a lot of parents listening who are still going to bed when their four-year-old goes to bed, and that's absolutely fine if they're happy with that.
Yeah.
But I know for me and my husband, I am always so excited about bedtime, like their bedtime, because after that I'm down, and that is the only time that I have relaxation, a bit of TV. It's nothing exciting. Yeah. You know, it's a bit of me time that I personally need. Now, I do appreciate not everyone needs that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I suppose I would just respect whatever people want. But let's say a lot of the clients that come to me, they have a kind of list of things that they'd like to achieve. And one of them would be interchangeability around bedtime, so that both parents, if there's two parents involved, are able to do it. And two, that they could have an evening, either to themselves or with each other. And I suppose, look, I think all those things are important. They can become important. So when it is something that's important to a parent, of course, I would always help them work their way through that. I think that helping your child fall asleep on their own, it can be difficult to do. And there's a couple of different ways of doing it. I have a particular approach. So I always use my stay and support approach. So whatever I'm trying to change, okay, I'm always going to introduce my stay and support approach. So let's say we're talking about a four-year-old in a bed, and we have involved them in the changes, because I feel with a four-year-old, you almost need to market the sleep process and invest them in their own sleep happiness. And so, as well as prioritizing timing, I also look at, let's say, creating a zone in the bedroom for bedtime to be taken. So bedtime happens in a space in the bedroom and not in the bed itself. So I create a difference between those two activities. And then I have a bedtime routine in the space that's about 20 minutes in duration, that's really involved in deep connection and engagement with your child. And then when it's lights out time, and I often use a lamp on a timer, I escort them to their bed. I get them to climb into their bed. And to begin with, instead of lying on the bed with them, I might sit beside them. So there's a shift there. Yeah. And if they're very unhappy with that, I'll be very physically available to them. I'll stroke and rub them. I'll shush and hum to them. I'll sing to them. And I'll hug to calm them. And I will help them get to sleep with me beside them rather than right next to them.
Yes.
And then I might do that for a whole week. And when I'm doing that, I'm normally doing two things. I'm establishing this beside you, and I'm also trying to establish what bedtime is supposed to be. So I always start off with a really early bedtime when I'm trying to figure that out. So I might start bedtime at 6:30 and have lights out at 10 to 7. And then over the course of that first week, a time will keep flashing up. You know, it could be 20 past 7, could be 10 past 8. That will represent the natural bedtime.
Okay. Yeah.
And then I know I take that information and I do two things with it. I either leave it alone for a while and I focus on moving myself out of the room. So I usually spend a whole week beside the cot. Now, again, people might be reading the book and say, well, you only say 4 days in the book. I know I do 4 to 7 days. OK, and I get you to judge it. And then after that length of time, I move into the middle of the room. And I might sit on a cushion. I might show them ahead of time, hey, look where I'm going to sit tonight. The challenge arises here is if they get out of bed, because now you're a little bit further away from them. So I would just say, look, I really want you to get into bed. I only will stay if you'll get into your bed. And normally at this stage, you've got a good relationship around it, that you've established the natural bedtime as a result. And then you're a little bit further away. And then you do that for about 3 nights and you move away further again. And then you move out of there. And then like with an older child, I might get to a point where I might say, hey, Harry, I'm just going to go to the bathroom. I'm going to be back in a minute to check on you.
Yeah.
That whole process takes me probably about a month, Sheena. Okay. And again, it's not without pitfalls, but you can hear there, I'm not using any reward charts. I'm not using anything like that because that doesn't chime with my philosophies. I'm looking to get the sleep addressed in as organic a way as possible.
That's very interesting. Yeah, because there is such a tendency to be like, oh, you know, sticker for you or anything. Yeah. Anything, if you'll stay in your own room.
I know, but you see, like, I mean, your own children, my children, my kid, I take a gold star, good luck with you.
I know.
Do you know, they weren't a bit interested in getting anything. And then maybe the first day, I think incentivizing that lowers self-esteem. And as a result, I don't want to do that. I want this to be, you can do this. I trust you. You've got all of the wisdom. And again, look, I'm only giving that to you in a very kind of basic way. In my first book, that's clearly outlined for parents to implement. And of course, in my online courses as well, for that, for all of the age groups, so that we work towards it and you're working collaboratively with your child and you're judging how they're processing it and you're helping to support them in how they experience that change.
And I assume all the what if scenarios are addressed in your book, you know, so what if
And I suppose for me it's about the foundation piece actually and building up towards it, and then I tend to find it works quite well. The biggest challenge is when parents have their children in a bed too soon and the child is too young to developmentally understand I'm going to move outside here, you know, they're in and then they're in and out like a yo-yo. So I suppose generally I try and encourage families to keep their children in their cots until 3+, so that developmentally we know that they have what we describe as being impulse control and that we can ask them to do something and we have an idea that they can see it through. So you're not asking too much of them, if that makes sense to you.
Yeah. And soothers. So I'm fascinated now because I know, all of mine used soothers and to be fair, I was pretty lucky once I had it attached to some sort of teddy, which I've used various ones over the years. But with soothers, I suppose they can reach around the bed looking for them if they fall out, but yet they can be really reliant on them. What's a good way to stop them waking up in the middle of the night looking for a soother?
Okay, so I'll give you two scenarios. First of all, I breastfed and extended breastfed all of my four children, and I also used a dummy with them too. And again, you'll know as well as I do that they tend to recommend to not introduce the dummy until your feeding is established. Okay, so then you make your decision around that yourself, right? But I did find, for me personally, that a dummy was a very good way of satisfying a baby who had a strong sucking reflex, and they were comforted hugely by it. I will say that my own children, we didn't use dummies beyond about 7 or 8 months. And again, I generally find that there is a window of opportunity somewhere between 6 and 9 months that if you were inclined to not want to use the dummy anymore, that you could look at offloading it or discontinuing the use. Now, we have to caveat that by saying, I'll always ask a parent to discuss that with their GP before making that decision. And you might be thinking, why would you do that? You know that the evidence is there that the use of dummies and SIDS, there's an interrelation there. So then there is an also piece to that, that if you've used a dummy at all in the first year, that it, you would want to take advice about whether to drop it or not. Does that make sense to
Absolutely,
you?
Absolutely, yeah.
If you're dropping a dummy, again, like if you're changing feeding to sleep or rocking to sleep or hand-holding to sleep, I'm always going to use my stay and support approach. Okay, and I'll always drop it at bedtime and I'll replace it with the stay and support approach. However, when we're dropping a dummy, I'll tell all of my clients this, it is up to your child really. And if they're more upset than you can manage, I would be giving it back to you. And I would say to you, you'll know in your soul if you can get rid of it or not.
I love that advice. I love that. I find that so reassuring for parents because I have found before, and I've written an article about the benefits actually of a soother, because there's something that get a very, very bad rep.
I know that you'd be like almost ashamed. Like, that's why I said to you, I want you to carry it by saying, look, I breastfed them all. I've used a dummy with them all.
And I'm exactly the same. And for the same reasons, I found that my children got great comfort from sucking on a dodi. You know, it was never a replacement for a feed, and it certainly was something I was conscious of, but just wasn't a problem for all three of my kids. You're absolutely right to highlight the link with SIDS, and what you're saying there just falls so true. Say in my house, I really stressed about the dummy maybe too much and eventually ended up just giving up that battle because it was just one that I chose to ignore. And I was like, oh, will we leave it out for the fairies? And they were like, no, no. And then a few days later, it was like, oh, Mammy, I'd like to leave that out for the fairies, you know? And they came to the decision themselves after being prompted. They just needed time. And then it was no argument as opposed to forcing it and it being so traumatic. Yeah.
And you see, sometimes they give it up quite willingly because they're not natural dummy users. When we have dummy users, that's what I call them anyway, I get parents to start putting it into their baby's hand and I guide the hand up to the mouth. So I would be beginning that from around 6 months, even though I know developmentally they're not really able to do, but they kind of are, you see. So I encourage the skill to start to emerge. So into the hand, hand over the mouth, I never put into their mouth for them. And then over time, I start making their hand look around for it. Now, obviously you've mentioned a teddy, and there are a couple of teddies that have like hands and they hold it. Yeah. I did go through a spate of time of recommending one of those when I was working with families. And then I suppose I just go through phases. So mostly I just use a dummy, not multiple dummies. And I don't have any attachments or anything like that. And I just teach them to use it. And then the other side of that is when they start chucking it out of the cot, how we might manage that.
Fetch mummy.
Yeah, a lot of the sleep pieces, they come down to like a management scenario almost. So you kind of have all these different instances and how do we manage that when that happens? So there's two major ones. One is when they start chucking the dummy out. And I suppose what I recommend is that you have spares on you. And then when you hear them chuck it or you see them chuck it, that you don't react to that and that you make them wait maybe 3 minutes or 5 minutes and then you just slip a new one in. So instead of doing a search and rescue mission, what could be kind of entertaining to your young child or kind of give them this sort of entertainment value, I kind of dilute that. But you kind of know, and I know that you have to give it to them because they need a dummy to go to sleep with, because they're dummy users. So there's a management piece to that. And then I do think if you just deal with it like that, it just dilutes it. And then the other piece that I often use that word about management is once they start standing in the cot. So well, there's two things. You know, I mentioned about a co-sleeper earlier. And in my day, as I said, it was a Moses basket. And I feel quite strongly about remembering to tell people it's really good to put your baby into a conventional cot from 4 months onwards, because whilst those co-sleepers are great in the beginning and they're the right environment for your baby in the beginning because they're nice and small and they have come from the womb, but once they start to get mobile from 4 months plus, they start to roll, actually spatially they need more. So I normally want them to go into a conventional cot from 4 months plus. And of course, they're so adaptable at this age group. And I think that's enough space for them then. And again, once they start rolling, you definitely don't want them in a swaddle. And I'm pretty sure you've written a blog about research, and I have too on my website, just about making an informed decision about the swaddle. But of course, once they start moving at all, we don't want them in anything except maybe a sleeping bag. And once they start rolling, just to assure parents that practice that skill loads during the day. And then once they start assuming their natural position, allow them to do this. So once you know they can get over and back and they want to sleep on their tummies or their side, allow them to and stop doing it for them, if that makes any sense to you. And then once they start standing up in the cot, it kind of depends on where you're at. So if you're currently staying with your child and they start standing, I normally put you low down on the floor. I practice the skill loads throughout the course of the day. I play Ring a Ring a Rosie with them. Then when they stand up in the cot, I stay low on the floor and I let them get it out of their system, and then I pop them down once. But if they stand back up again, I talk them down. And of course, if you don't stay and they start standing, I judge it. I see, can I leave the room, come back in and lay them down and go again? But sometimes you might need to temporarily go down to the cot side and teach them to do it so that you can get back on track once that developmental skill has kind of passed them. It's going to stay, but the excitement of it is going to pass.
And then you've got the children who are pretty much pole vaulting out or scaling the side of the cot.
Well, you see, I suppose that did cross my mind as I kind of throw out all of my sort of projections about 3-year-olds in beds and 2-year-olds in beds. Safety is at the core of this. However, when a child starts to climb out of the cot, but I get curious, why are you climbing?
Yeah.
So rather than saying, okay, you need to go into a bed for your safety's sake, I'm asking other questions. Like normally if I've got a climber, they might be being put into that cot already asleep.
Yeah. Okay.
And they want to pole vault out of it, Sheena, because they're not safe there.
Yeah. Okay. So they're in an environment that they're not trusting because they weren't comfortable enough to fall asleep there.
Yeah. Or they keep standing up and we keep hooking them out. So you're teaching them you're not safe here because I keep taking you out. So I get curious rather than knee-jerk reaction around converting into a big bed. But I'm always going to prioritize safety. But you can hear what I'm saying here. It's not my first port of call. I'll always look and see what's contributing to this. And like sometimes it's just they're just not getting enough exercise. They're not on the trampoline enough. They're not outside enough. And then I start making obstacle courses for them during the day with my cushions of my couch and things like that, because I'm trying to see, can I exhaust this need somewhere else in the day and diffuse it and dilute it at night.
Okay, Lucy, what is the hardest part of your job?
Oh, We'd need a whole podcast. We'd need like a whole 2 more hours for me to tell you about that.
You're going to have to bullet point.
I suppose the hardest part of my job is that I feel a huge responsibility for parents when they come to me. And it's results-based, but it's human behaviour. And then there's so many dimensions to that. So I often feel under pressure because the parent is so vulnerable and I have been put in a position of trust. And although I know that we're going to get there, that road can be very difficult sometimes. And I feel sometimes pressure around that. And I am just a solo practitioner. And, you know, anyone who watches my videos, like, this is where I sit all day long. This is it. This is the place. And I think that can be lonely for somebody sometimes, you know, that kind of sole practitioner. Like, sometimes I get emails, especially on Instagram, saying, hey, Lucy and team. And I'm like, there is no team.
It's just me.
I know. So I sometimes find that difficult. But mostly, if I'm honest with you, it's a lovely, lovely job. I suppose it's a responsibility, but you probably feel that in your job too.
What you're saying there is mirrored by a lot of parents around the country, you know, in whatever line of work they're in. And just be reassured, I know you know what you're doing because you see your results and you don't need me to tell you, but you're fabulous at what you do. So I think it's amazing to hear that everyone, even the best of the best, feels the burden of the job that they're doing. On a lighter note, to finish it up, what is your favourite part of the job?
Oh, you know, I just love it when there's a shift. And that shift doesn't even need to be the gold standard shift. It just needs to be a shift. And then to hear things like, well, today that person who said that they felt closer to their daughter, like, that nearly made me cry. That made me emotional, to be honest with you. Or to hear that someone who wasn't drinking is now drinking, or someone who wasn't eating very well is now eating. Of course, I love when I hear they've slept, you know, the first 4 hours, the first 6 hours of their life, or a nap that's touched the 1 hour mark. But sometimes it's the kind of background stuff that, you know, when you hear a mum saying that she feels more like herself today, or that the fog is lifting, or that they went on a date night together. Those things sometimes, Sheena. And then, you know, when I'm finishing with a client, they always kind of say, I know you hear this all the time, but you know what? I can never hear it enough, because I suppose it removes anything that is challenging in any job, but let's say in my job, it dilutes all of that. It changes it altogether. And it just makes it worthwhile. So the long hours, the pressure is completely diffused by, I suppose, making a difference.
And I think, yeah, sleep is one of, if not the most important thing, because the impact it has on mental and emotional well-being, physical well-being, like sustained lack of sleep is torture. And the relief that parents find and the breath it gives back to people and to couples to have that bit of space and rest to recharge the battery so that they can enjoy the time with their children, I think that's an invaluable gift to give.
It's pretty special.
Thank you so much for joining me here today, Lucy, on the Wonder Baba podcast. It's been an absolute pleasure. And as I said, I just need to go back in time and listen to this 10 years ago so that I'd crack parenting once and for all. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.